Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, gather around the radio. It's time for another installment of A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. My name is Michael Harrison. I am privileged to serve as anchor of the show. It's an ensemble show, lots of good people involved. And the host and founder of the program, its guiding light, if you will, is Carol Marks. Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues, and she's a champion in the battle against ageism. Let's kick it off right now with Carol Marks in conversation with Paul Ingrassia. He's formerly the Detroit bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal and later served as president of Dow Jones Newswires. He's going to talk to Carol about his fascinating new book titled Engines of Change, A History of the American Dream in 15 Cars, published by Simon & Schuster.
So how did Chevy's Corvette, the first American sports car, reflect what was going on in America?
Well, it was a very interesting time, you know, in America. The Corvette was introduced in 1953. And think about that year for a minute. It was a seminal year in modern history. It was the year the Korean War ended. It was the career a young man named Elvis started recording music. And it was the year that another young man named Hugh Hefner started a magazine called Playboy. Dwight Eisenhower went to the White House, and a young guy from Massachusetts, John F. Kennedy, went to the U.S. Senate. So there were a lot of things going on, but with the end of the Korean War, what you get is this picture of this generation of Americans that had grown up knowing really two things, depression and then war. All of a sudden, it's peace and prosperity, and people want to let loose a little bit. And here comes this, you know, kind of good-looking sports car, the Corvette, that really sort of captured that spirit. The downside, actually, was that all the Corvette did at first was look good, because it really wasn't much of a performance automobile. It took a guy named Zora Arkus Duntov, who was a GM engineer, who was raised, ironically, as a Bolshevik boy in pre-revolution St. Petersburg, who found his way to America, fell in love with the Corvette, and helped improve it and make it a real sports car.
Now, what made you write that Corvette's horsepower, like the length of women's skirts, provided kind of an indicator of America's economic strength? And isn't that also true today when it comes to, you know, how powerful our engines are or aren't?
Well, yeah, in a lot of ways it is. I mean, you think a lot of today's most popular cars have engines that are not as powerful as they would be without the hybrid element in. But if you think about the Corvette, really sort of it started out with a very small, actually a six-cylinder engine. It wasn't until a few years later it got a V8, and by the late '60s it was 350 horsepower or more. But by the 70s, when the gasoline crises hit and, you know, we had stagflation and inflation and all that kind of stuff, basically the Corvette went actually down to 165 horsepower. That's about as powerful as a average subcompact four-cylinder car today.
Wow. Now, here's something I've always wondered about. The popularity of an automobile that never changed its model. It had been Adolf Hitler's car. Of course, I'm talking about the Volkswagen Beetle. So how did that become a symbol for its time?
Well, it really became the counterculture symbol of the 60s. And, you know, don't forget, you had the Beetle, which was actually developed by Ferdinand Porsche at the behest of Adolf Hitler. And Hitler gave the car its first name, which was not Beetle, but it was Kraft durch Freude Wagen, which means the strength through joy car, kind of an unwieldy name, but I don't know. For some reason, nobody wanted to argue with the Fuhrer about the name. Only a few were built before the war, but in the 50s, what happened was Volkswagen decided it needed modern production equipment. They wanted to buy it in the one place that made it well, and that's the United States. So they started shipping Beetles over here to sell to Americans so they could get hard currency, dollars, to buy American machinery. And that's how it sort of took off. Gradually, year by year, it got more and more accepted. And then right around 1960, this really sort of offbeat, funny, humorous, self-deprecating advertising started by a firm called Doyle Dane Birnbach, in which the Volkswagen people, the ads sort of made fun of the car. Like with ad, one of the slogans was, "It's ugly, but it gets you there." Well, you know, no other car company advertised any product like that. So it really, especially after the tail fin era of the early of the late 1950s, the Beetle was this counterculture reaction to that, small, minimalist, and functional, and it really caught on among the counterculture.
And as you point out in the book, really, America has really always struggled with two different views about possessions. Either they're practical or they're pretentious. And you just mentioned the tail fins, which got longer and better, so they said.
Longer and bigger, yep.
And I couldn't believe they said that they were actually a safety feature. Now, how could that be? They hit
well,
the other car first.
It couldn't be. It really wasn't true. But, you know, automobile advertising and marketing knows no bounds when it comes to hyperbole, Carol. So at one point, Chrysler, the big tail fin war of the 50s was really a Chrysler versus General Motors war. But at one point, Chrysler advertised its tail fins as graceful directional stabilizers. they actually claimed to have research that showed in a high crosswinds that the stability of a car was improved by up to 30% if it had big tail fins.
Now, along came the 60s and the popularity of Ford's Mustang. So what made it so appealing?
Well, the Mustang really, you know, think about it. First of all, the timing made it appealing. It came along in 1964. It was a time when, you know, most households were still one-car households. Can you believe that? But it's true. And the Mustang sold for less than $2,500, but it was sporty. It looked good. It was economical to run. And it really was roomy enough for a family of four. So basically, you had people who were either getting their driver's licenses or going off to college or starting families, and it just caught on because the style was, the styling and the price were just right. And the funny thing about it is that the Mustang really was not, in no way was it a technological innovation. It was really a, sort of a hot, sexy body style put on top of the chassis of the old Ford Falcon. And it really was quite a good, you know, it just caught on because the fact that they reused the Falcon architecture to build the Mustang let Ford sell it for a very reasonable price.
Now, here you have in the 60s the practical car, the Ford's Mustang, and then you have the GM's Pontiac GTO, which was a car that represented kind of rebellion at the time.
Yeah, the GTO was started by John DeLorean. It was his invention, his development when he ran Pontiac, and he was sort of the rebel of Detroit, the executive rebel, you know, with long hair and tight-fitting suits and cowboy boots to the office and all that. And, you know, DeLorean basically developed this. But all the GTO was a big engine in the body of a fairly small car, the Pontiac Tempest. But it really, it went fast, and it was just sort of a, you know, it started this whole boy racer craze of the late 1960s. And you think about the Mustang and the GTO sort of capturing the two different distinct parts of the 60s. The early 60s.
They sure did.
Were all about the Beatles and civil rights and the Mustang. That was the tame period. And then the late 60s, things took a darker turn, and it was about the Rolling Stones and about urban riots, and then, of course, the GTO as opposed to the Mustang. So it was really sort of a snarly, in-your-face car of its day.
And then along came an automobile from a third-tier Japanese company. I never knew that it was, and they produced the Honda. And that's really had a great impact on our buying habits. And, again, it had to do with the price of gas, I think.
Well, absolutely. You think about the 70s. The 70s were not a good time in America, right? I mean, we had Watergate. We had defeat in Vietnam. We had two oil crises. We had stagflation. We had Jimmy Carter and malaise. You know, we had bell-bottom pants. We had disco dancing. I mean, all kinds of bad things were going on in America in the 70s. It was sort of a, you know, a waking up from the, you know, hangover from the 60s, really. And along, you know, American cars, Detroit rushed to downsize its cars. really because gas prices soared at the beginning in 1973 with the first oil crisis. And for a while, you couldn't even buy gas every day. It was even odd license plates on every other day. And Honda comes along with this car called the Accord that is practical and reliable because they knew how to make small cars. And when Detroit rushed overnight to downsize its cars, they made a lot of engineering mistakes. And you had disasters like the Chevy Vega, the Ford Pinto, or the AMC Gremlin, which was actually introduced on April Fool's Day, 1970. So anyway, the Accord comes along mid-decade and is reliable, not flashy. And then what really made that car capture the essence of America a few years later was in 1982 it became the first foreign nameplate car to be successfully built in the United States. And it really brought the whole globalization of the world economy home to America in a firm, visible way, if you will.
Now, talking about the price of gas, it seems to me that that's going to be the force that we have, high gas prices, to get Americans to change to autos that are going to be powered by a new technology. Do you have any idea what that's going to be?
Well, it's going to be some form of hybrid technology and maybe at some point some form of natural gas or electric technology, but it probably will not be the conventional battery-powered electric car. The problem with batteries is they just can't get them to go last long enough on a charge. So basically, you have cars like the Nissan Leaf that gets 70 or 80 miles on one charge, and people are worried they'll run out of juice right in the middle of their trip. Hybrids get around that very well. Now, Toyota, for example, which developed the Prius, by far the world's best-selling gas electric hybrid car, has really shifted most of its advanced engine research away from electric batteries and toward fuel cell powered batteries. So there's all kinds of basic research going on that's very, very exciting. But I think that hybrids are going to be the sort of a bridge to the future, whatever the future is going to be.
Paul Ingrassia in conversation with Carol Marx. His book is titled Engines of Change, A History of the American Dream in 15 Cars, published by Simon & Schuster. A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues in a moment.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray. Check out our website at atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. That's atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E.
Touch of Grey continues now with Carol Marx interviewing novelist Kathy Pelletier about her new novel in the Madigash series, One Way Bridge, a novel.
What is it about the desires and troubles of the people who live there that you really wanted to write about? And when did you know that you wanted to write?
Well, I grew up in the little town of Allegash, Maine, which is at the very end of the road in northern Maine, and very isolated. And so that was my fictional landscape. As a writer, most of us rely upon the geography where we grew up. And so that, of course, was mine. And I knew when I was 10 years old, I started writing down little poems and cute things and kind of Hallmarkian stuff. And then when John Kennedy, President Kennedy, was assassinated, my writing took another turn, and I became a little bit more subjective. And strangely, many writers I have met in that generation also were affected by that assassination.
Now, at what point did you want to become a songwriter? Because you did move to Nashville, Tennessee. And what did you learn from that experience? Did it play any role in your going on to write the first in the Madigash series?
It played a major role. I have said this before, and I just came back from a tour in the South, in Tennessee and Mississippi and Alabama, and I've said the same. When I went to the South, I found my literary voice. I did go there to write songs, to learn the craft of songwriting, and my intention was to attend graduate school at Vanderbilt. And I met all these songwriters and saw how many hours a week they spend honing their craft and learning to use that economy of words that they use, much like a poet uses. And so Ezra Pound once said that without music, the poetry withers and dies. So I think that trying to put my thoughts onto that small canvas that a songwriter uses taught me how to look at a sentence structure, how to think of cadence in a line. And I think I came to the point where I thought, I can spend the next several years trying to learn songwriting, or I can concentrate on becoming a fiction writer, and I chose fiction writing.
And you know, the power of the words you write is really something, and they're beautiful. I want to ask you about this book's title, The One-Way Bridge. How did you come up with that? Was that from watching a news clip?
It was from watching a news clip. As I say in the author's note at the back of the book, I was still living in Nashville, Tennessee, and I had grown up in the town of Allegash, as I said, born and raised in the house that I'm again living in, my father built. There were three one-way bridges in this little town, two relatively long ones, one crossed the Allegash River, one the St. John, and another shorter one crossed the tinier little Black River. And I had never put a one-way bridge in my fiction. And one night in Tennessee, I had been out with songwriters, and I came home and couldn't sleep. It was those days when Linda Ellerbe used to keep us insomniacs entertained all night with little clips on CNN. And I saw this clip of a one-way bridge going out in an ice jam, and I was mesmerized. And suddenly, beneath the picture comes the caption, St. John River Bridge, Allegash, Maine, and I was shocked. It was the middle of the night, so I couldn't really call home. And so that's when I got up the next day and started taking down notes and trying to think in terms of how would a one-way bridge fit in a novel. The bridge itself is such an amazing literary device. I mean, it's kind of been used a lot. But a one-way bridge, you know, you have to take turns using it. That takes the metaphor up a notch.
Oh, it certainly does, because, you know, on a one-way bridge, you can convey the message about it that if you're only going in one direction in life on that one-way bridge, maybe you need to turn around and go in another direction.
You are exactly right. That's exactly right. Sometimes a one-way bridge signifies that maybe your life is also narrow and going in maybe a wrong direction. You're absolutely right, Carol.
Now, I love the fact that you have a lot of humor in your book, and I laugh so hard at the absolutely absurd mailbox. One of the characters, Sergeant Harry Plunkett, he put up, and it certainly annoyed the mailman, Orville Kraft. So what did the mailbox look like? It makes me laugh when I think about it. And what did the mailman have to do to put mail in it?
Well, I don't think this is giving away the story. It's right in
it doesn't really.
It's right in the beginning of the book. Harry Plunkett has gone to Quebec, where, as Orville Kraft says, everyone is French, and bought a mailbox that is shaped like a moose. And that was bad enough. He's taunting Orville, of course, because Orville takes his postal code, his postal rules book, very seriously. And so he puts up this moose mailbox, and that was indignity enough. But the last week when the novel opens, Orville has five more days of delivering the mail before he retires. So Harry decides to take the feud between them up a notch, and he turns the moose mailbox around so that now, and with a bit of soldering and sawing, now the moose's hindquarters are what Orville has to open to put mail into the box. And that's the largest insult he's ever had as a postal servant.
I bet. And now the characters in your book, they're both endearing. They're eccentric. Sometimes they're emotionally scarred. And we just discussed some of the humor behind Sergeant Plunkett's mailbox. But you also write about his devastating experiences in Vietnam and how he's haunted by them. When you were 16, you became a pen pal with someone who served in Vietnam. And you finally got to meet him, I guess, 40 years later. Did that influence you to talk about Vietnam and what it has done to our brave servicemen who have served there?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. I did not want Harry Plunkett to be a Vietnam vet because I felt too restricted as a writer. I mean, I'm certainly not a Vietnam vet. I've never been to Vietnam, never been to war. So I did not want him to start having these kinds of flashbacks. Whether or not that soldier I actually wrote to when I was 16, and yes, we did meet 40 years later, he still had the picture I sent him and the letters, which amazed me. Whether or not that was in my subconscious mind and it surfaced as Harry started talking, I don't know. Characters bring things out of our subconscious mind. It seems as if they're doing and saying things and we're only recording it. You'll hear many, many authors say that. They feel that way about their characters. But, of course, they're getting that out of our subconscious minds. That's where that's coming from as we create them. So I don't know. Maybe it was there. It's certainly in my conscious mind now, having met him. I was so glad that I had done it. But it was a daunting task because I had to do much, much research. And then did I have it correct? Did I have the emotional feelings correct? That was a bit frightening, but I did ask a couple of Vietnam vets, one a medic, to read what I had written. And hopefully hopefully I'm at least close. How can we ever know when we haven't experienced the heinous acts of war ourselves? How do we know? We can only surmise.
Absolutely. Now, because you do it so beautifully, how are you able to balance the humor in your books that you write with the more dramatic storylines that you always have?
Well, that's always a bit treacherous for a writer. You wonder sometimes, have I taken this character a little too far over the comic ledge? Am I able to then pull him back? And after the reader has been laughing at him for a while, am I able to let them see inside his heart and soul and have them then feel that he is redeemable and likable, even lovable? So it's always a bit tricky. But again, the characters sort of tell me what they want to do, so I trust them. And I trust that trunk in my subconscious mind, I guess, and hopefully it works. I mean, maybe for some readers it doesn't. We all have a different sense of where to draw the line in humor. And so maybe for some readers it might not work, but I've been hearing from readers that do like the book, so I hope that.
Oh, it's gotten great reviews, and you know, I personally loved it and couldn't put it down, and I'm just amazed because you have all these different stories in your book that are so interesting, and you're able to tie them all up, so that's real talent. Kathy, what do you hope readers will learn or take away from this book?
Well, I think one thing, you know, growing up at the end of the world, it seemed to me as a child, because back then it was very, very isolated. I might get into the little town of Fort Kent once a month, especially in the winter when the deep snows came, and the snows were very deep, especially when you're a child. We all have our own knowledge of the world. Human beings, that you don't have to live in New York City or London or Paris to understand those universal qualities that make us all human and make us aspire to chase our dreams or make us good human beings who will care for the planet Earth. It doesn't matter where you're born. What matters is your heart. And I'm hoping that, you know, these characters are very rural. Some of them are not that well-educated. They're not well-traveled. Some are. But they all, in the end, they all achieve the same kind of worldliness that humans can hope for as they spend their time on the planet. And that's what I would hope. You don't have to be from New York City to be worldly.
That's Kathy Pelletier in conversation with Carol Marx. Her novel is titled The One-Way Bridge, a novel published by Sourcebooks. For more information, go to kathypelletier.com, CathyPelletier.com. A Touch of Grey continues in just a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security web pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
This is a Driving Today Minute. Even though high gasoline prices have moderated somewhat, they're still quite high. It just makes good sense to do what you can do to reduce your fuel costs. The Alliance to Save Energy suggests a few easy things you can do.
Keep your car properly tuned up and change the air filter regularly, both to save gas and protect your engine. Curtail aggressive driving, according to the U.S. Department of Energy. Speeding, rapid acceleration, and hard braking waste gas and curb mileage by as much as 33% at highway speeds.
So nix the jackrabbit starts and opt instead for slow acceleration from a dead stop. Slow down. The DOE says each mile per hour you drive over 60 is like paying an extra 10 cents per gallon. Inflate tires to the proper pressure. This will increase fuel economy and make tires safer and extend their life.
This Driving Today Minute is brought to you by Bridgestone Firestone Tires. You can get more information like this at drivingtoday.com or by visiting our partners such as autobytel.com, motorsportsforum.com, and more.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray. Check out our website at atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. That's atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to godirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and we come to that point in the program where we're joined by our senior correspondent, Kevin Casey, who in addition to being on this program is a regular featured member of our cast. He is also the vice president and executive editor of the trade magazine Talkers, which is the trade publication in the talk radio business. Kevin, baseball. Baseball is very, very much a sport that really works well on radio, don't you think?
Absolutely. The speed of play and everything is just engenders itself to radio.
And you don't have to know the game intimately to be able to follow it
right.
Like you do with the other three big sports. Now, coming up is the big All-Star game.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if All-Star games have the same amount of interest that they did when I know when I was growing up, and I know a lot of the people listening to the show were an upper demographic-oriented program. Back when the leagues were separated, when there was a distinct difference between the National League and the American
Yes.
League, you'd go to the All-Star game and you'd get to see players that you heard of, but that because of television rights being different or perhaps you didn't have a team in your city of that league, you really never got to see them.
No, and you're right when you say that the leagues were so different. Even even when I was much younger, you know, the National League was the fastball league, and mm-hmm. the American League was the junk ball league. They had the designated hitter, that weird thing to National League fans, and the coming together of these two things was really novel.
Right. So when you saw them and playing each other, there was something very exotic about it. Well, I found it even exotic as a kid growing up in New York City, listening to AM radio late at night,
and you would hear, you know, coming in through what's called Skywave at night when stations go much further than they do during the day, you'd pick up a baseball game from another city. And this was during the years when we didn't have National League Baseball in New York, before the Mets started and after the Dodgers and Giants left.
Yeah.
So if you heard the Dodgers or the Giants or the Cardinals or the Phillies,
Pirates,
or the Pirates, or any of the great National League teams in those days, it was like, oh my gosh, I'm listening to a National League game, because you just didn't see them on TV, you didn't hear them on the radio, you just knew they existed, and maybe you got to see them in the All-Star game, and you got to see them later in the World Series. Where's it happening this year?
It's at Citi Field in New York, the Mets, home of the Mets.
Speak of New York, Citi Field. I guess they're going to have a bigger crowd than they've been having lately.
I'm sure they hope so.
Well, I follow sports, but I'm not really up on this. Do All-Star games draw big crowds?
You know, they do, because it's people come out. They love to have it in their home stadium. So even if people don't travel a lot like they do for some of the other All-Star events, the local people like to come out and say, hey, we got the All-Star game in our ballpark.
Mm. And this year, New York baseball fans can use whatever they can get. You know, the Subway Series that only a few cities have the opportunity to do, Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and New York, as far as I could think off the top of my head.
Yeah.
You know, we have two cities, two teams in the same city. Even when the Mets and the Yankees are not playing well, the bragging rights that go with their two Subway Series a year are extraordinary. So, well, New York deserves a break today.
Yeah.
Thank you, Kevin. Kevin Casey, our senior correspondent. He is the vice president and executive editor of Talkers. You can learn anything you want to know about talk radio behind the scenes at talkers.com. I'm Michael Harrison, and A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues right here in just a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on matchingdonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. Matchingdonors.com improves those odds by finding living altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to matchingdonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's matchingdonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security websites. Pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said you're the picture of health? You look healthy. You feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/medicareonly.
at socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and here is our senior correspondent, Steve Wiseman, with us the rest of the way. He's in conversation with Karen Peterson. She's founder and director of Giving Back, a nonprofit organization dedicated to improving the lives of elders through intergenerational mentoring. She's going to talk to Steve about her new book titled Move with Balance, Healthy Aging Activities for Brain and Body, published by Giving Back.
You know, balance is so important, particularly for seniors. And is it primarily because of the concern with falls, or are there other reasons why balance is important as well?
Well, I think it is primarily the reason of falling, because so many elders do fall. But, you know, it's just something that would be beneficial to work on as an overall for your health.
You know, and it's interesting, too. I know a lot of people, and even a lot of seniors who will do aerobic exercise. They will do strength training, but they don't do balance exercises. And those are really, really important, aren't they?
Yes, and I think what's unique or innovative about the exercises that I have in the Move with Balance book is that they are balance exercises, and that they combine cognitive exercises too in many of the exercises.
Yeah, you know, that was one of the things that fascinated me the most, particularly some exercises that you would do while having a cognitive component at the same time, like you might be counting backwards while you're doing a certain exercise. Why is that?
So I'll give you an example of one. I think that'll make it easier to understand. So let's just say that somebody is pretending that they're walking on a tightrope, and you put one foot in front of the other and walk along slowly, and that in itself is somewhat hard, the closer your foot is in front of the other one. And then you're going along, and then maybe I'm going to say, okay, everyone lift up their heads, because the tendency is to have their head looking at the ground.
Right.
And then I'd say, okay, now everyone look over to the right. And that kind of throws off your whole balance, and you have to adjust to that. So all of these exercises, while we're doing them, the vestibular system is making the fine adjustments. Okay, then let's say we all walk backwards. And this is only according to what each senior is able to do. You know, we're progressively making it a little more difficult.
Sure.
Okay, so then we walk backwards. And then maybe I'll say, okay, now count backwards from 100 by threes. Okay, so while you're doing that, you're really having to think while you move, which is just another whole, you know, aspect of what you would have to do in real life. And we're kind of just practicing real life and getting ourselves adjusted and balanced so that when these things occur, we've got it in our brain-body systems.
There's a lot going on there. It's a good thing you're not asking me to chew gum while I do it. There's just no way.
Yeah.
You know, problem is designed to enhance what we call, I guess, whole brain integration. What is that whole brain integration, and how does that benefit us?
Well, one side of our brain is looking at the details and processing that, and the other side is putting those details into a whole picture. And when we perceive that way, we're getting an accurate picture. We just feel and much more in a state of well-being when we are connected like that. And out of habit over the years, people tend to use one brain over the other, like being too focused or spaced out. Mm-hmm. So if you can get this connected, these circuits, it's just a much more of a feeling of well-being and balance, because we do have two eyes, two ears, and two brains, so we bring those into a state of balance.
And only one mouth, which is why we should listen twice as much as we talk.
Yeah,
now,
that's right.
I like the book comes with a access to an online video, and there's some great pictures. But one of the things I notice is you really don't need a lot of equipment that someone wouldn't find around the house to do this,
yep.
Do you?
Right, and that's the way I've been doing it for a long time, and that's how I wanted to do it. I didn't want to make it where I had to buy fancy, expensive equipment. Plus, I had to carry the stuff to all the different sites where I worked with the seniors, so I couldn't have a lot of heavy things either. So it's just things like bean bags or tennis balls, a few things like that. Because another thing that we're working on is reaction time,
mm-hmm.
which often in regular senior fitness classes, like you said, strength training or aerobics, you're not working on, you know, reaction time. So a lot of those things might be doing that. For instance, when I was talking about walking along like a tightrope walker, maybe your partner would throw a beanbag to you and you'd have to catch it, or you'd be throwing beanbags up yourself and catching them.
Is this something that is generally done better in a group setting, or does it, I know you certainly can do it alone, but does it enhance to do this with others?
Well, for the last probably about 19 years when I've been creating the whole thing, I did have it in a group, and I did pick younger, fit seniors, not necessarily younger, but let's say fit, mobile mm-hmm. seniors, to be mentors to the frail seniors. And it just helped, both of them became friends. It just added that piece of socialization, too. You don't necessarily have to do it in a group. One library in Kansas bought the book, and they've started a program right there in the library.
Oh, that's
so
terrific.
It could be done like that.
Now, you also
It doesn't have to have partners. It's just more fun, and you're more motivated if you do it together. And the exercises are a lot of fun, so it's, you know, good to have a laugh with a partner.
That's for sure. You even have some things on there as far as exercises for your vision. How do those work?
Well, in order to have depth perception, again, the two eyes have to work together. You know, and so I have exercises that are allowing that to happen so that your two eyes work together. And that also encourages the two brains to work together because each eye is connected to a brain. So then the two brains work together. Again, one of the goals that we're working on.
How long are the training sessions optimally?
Well, in the way that I have been doing them, they're an hour long. But, excuse me. If somebody was a caregiver for their parent or a professional caregiver, they could make a stop at someone's house, do them for 5 or 10 minutes, do a couple of exercises, and then move on. And that would also be beneficial. And another thing that works that I've recently discovered is grandchildren doing it with grandparents.
Oh, that's terrific. And I guess it also brings up something, particularly some of these balance exercises and exercises. They're great for anyone of any age. You do have levels, though. Someone shouldn't feel I'm not in good enough shape to start, or I'm in too good shape for this. This really is for all levels, isn't it?
Right. And I've done it in a nursing home, even, where a lot of the people are in a wheelchair. So they were not working on balance in the vestibular system as much as just the cognitive and the alertness. And what's kind of underlying the whole thing is that we're learning something new. And that's when we feel most alive, when we're engaged in what we're doing. We're right in the present moment, and we create new neural pathways in the brain. And it's just a feeling of well-being and aliveness that occurs when you do these. And that's, you know, somebody that it thinks that they can't do that, the exercises, can approach it from that way. And then we've actually had somebody in a wheelchair end up using a walker at the end.
Wow.
Of course, because he got confidence in himself and was able to then not use the wheelchair, and he was really a fun guy.
You know, you mentioned the new neural pathways, and we can teach old dogs new tricks, and our brains don't necessarily have to totally deteriorate as we get older. We can maintain and even create, as you say, new neural pathways. So this is something people shouldn't be afraid, well, it's not going to work, because your mind does regenerate, doesn't it?
Right. That's exactly right.
Where can people
When people are older, often they're sitting more, so they're getting sedentary, and that's what I think they're losing their balance skills, because they're not taxing their system by doing things that make their balance system kick in.
That's Karen Peterson in conversation with Steve Wiseman. Her new book is titled Move with Balance, Healthy Aging Activities for Brain and Body, published by Giving Back. And you can go to movewithbalance.org for more information. Steve Wiseman will be back in just a moment, and he's going to discuss airline ticket scams when A Touch of Grey continues.
You're age 65, and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/MedicareOnly. That's socialsecurity.gov/MedicareOnly.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
She's conquered some of the most challenging ski courses anywhere, but with only one leg, the odds were against her even walking.
The growth was stunted in my right leg when I was born, and the doctors told my mother we needed to amputate when I was 5 years old.
Bonnie was helped at a Shriners Hospital, one of a network of 22 hospitals helping kids throughout North America. Shriners Hospitals provide world-class orthopedic and burn medical care, and they offer that care totally free of charge.
The care and treatment the Shriners gave me was a gift. It wasn't just about learning to walk. They helped me to believe in myself.
There's a Shriners Hospital helping kids from this area realize their dreams.
If I went back to the Shriners Hospital and talked to the nurses and doctors, I would say thank you. Thank you for making my dreams come true.
If you know a child they could help, call 1-800-237-5055. Shriners, giving help and hope to kids for over 80 years.
Engines.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to GoDirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Continuing now with A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. We come to the final segment of our hour, and we're joined again by our senior correspondent, Steve Wiseman, the ubiquitous writer and attorney, expert on so many of the subjects we talk about, and a fierce opponent of con artists. He has a website that you should visit. It's scamaside.com. He has a book you should read. It's called The Truth About Avoiding Scams, published by Prentice Hall. And now here he is to discuss airline ticket scams. Steve?
Thank you, Michael. You know, there's a new scam that's making its way around the Internet, although it really is one that keeps on surfacing. It involves phony airline tickets. And you get an email that looks like it's from, and believe it, U.S. Airlines. Okay, well, here's a good indication that this is a scam. There is no U.S. Airlines. There is a U.S. Airways, but there is no U.S. Airlines. It looks good. Seeing the emails themselves, they have a logo on there for the non-existent airline. Looks pretty official. As scams go, pretty good one. It will say that you've just won two airline tickets, and it will give you a number to call to claim the tickets. Sometimes they'll have variations of this scam where you'll be able to click on a link and provide the information to get them. Now remember, first of all, It's very hard to win a contest or a lottery. It's damn near impossible to win one that you never even entered. And that's the situation here. What happens is, if you do call that phone number or if you do click on the link, what will happen is one of two things. If you call the phone number, they're going to ask you for personal information in order to have you qualify for this ticket. When you give that personal information, it's going to be used against you to turn you into a victim of identity theft. So you don't want to do that. They call this phishing with a PH. The other thing is, if you click on that link, a lot of times what happens there is, instead of you'll also go to a place where you can provide information, but what unknowingly you will end up doing is downloading something called a keystroke logging malware program. And essentially, it's kind of a special program virus that goes into your computer. You don't even know it's there, and it steals all of the information from your computer, can turn you into a victim of identity theft, can give someone access to your bank account, all bad stuff. The key thing is, you got to be skeptical whenever you win a free a contest that you haven't entered. You also never click on links unless you're absolutely sure of from where it's coming. In the case of something like this, if you have even the slightest thought that it might be legitimate, what you do is you call the airline at a number that you get online knowing is correct, not the one that's in that email. That's when you're going to find out, particularly with this particular one, that there is no U.S. airline. If you want some more information, you can go to my website, scamicide.com, and find out about the latest of these scams.
Thank you, Stephen J.J. Wiseman. Steve Wiseman talking about airline ticket scams. His book, The Truth About Avoiding Scams, is published by Prentice Hall, and his website is scamicide.com. Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Beverly Santanello, our producer on the front line, putting it all together. Thank you, Carol Marks, host and founder of the program. Thanks, Kevin Casey, for joining us from Talkers Magazine. I'm Michael Harrison, inviting you to join us next weekend right here for another hour, another installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups.